morning. Some of you have asked me before, why are you always late to the 11 o'clock service? And it's not that I'm trying to be fashionably late, but if you're a guest, you may not realize that we have another service that takes place at the very same time over in what we call our B3 auditorium. And speaking of fashion, somebody accused me today of trying to look like Donald Trump with my tie and blue jacket. Well, if this was a Donald Trump tie, it would need to come down to about here somewhere. So I'm not trying to imitate it. I want to call your attention this morning to 2 Samuel. We're going to start in chapter 12, and then we're going to move over to 2 Samuel chapter 6 here in a little while. 2 Samuel chapter 12. So out in West Texas, there was a little boy that was growing up kind of in a rural part of West Texas. And for facilities, his family had an outhouse. And of course, this story took place many years ago. And the little boy absolutely hated the outhouse. It was cold in the wintertime. It was hot in the summertime. It was full of bugs and spiders. And it stunk all the time. So the little boy had this fantasy about somehow being able to push this rather permanent porta potty into the creek that ran right behind the outhouse. Well, one spring, they get this really hard spring rain. And the creek is really swollen, and the little boy thinks to himself, this is my opportunity. So he goes to the barn, and he gets a 2x4, and he comes back, and he's leveraging it like a giant crowbar, and he rocks it, and finally, he pushes the outhouse into the creek. And the little boy knew that at some point with his parents, it was going to hit the fan, so to speak. So he started thinking about what he would do if it came up. And so that evening for supper, he goes to supper and he's sitting there and his dad tells him, son, after supper, we're going to the woodshed. So he decided strategy one would be to play innocent. So he looks at his dad and he goes, what for? He said, well, someone overturned the outhouse today, and it was you, wasn't it, son? So then he decides to switch to his second strategy. He says, well, Dad, you know, I read that George Washington, when he cut down the cherry tree, since he told his dad the truth, he wouldn't be punished. And his dad said, yeah, but George Washington wasn't in the cherry tree when George Washington chopped it down. Well, this morning, we're going to be looking at King David, who, like this young lad, made a big, big mistake. And just like this little boy, he also tried to lie and cover it up. So we're going to be looking at King David in our series, as we're calling this the story, as we're just kind of journeying chronologically through the entire Bible. And one of the things that you notice about David is that his family situation just wasn't very good. And so what we're going to do for the next couple weeks is we're going to kind of do a mini-series inside of our main series and look at the next 2 weeks, look at the subject of marriage and family. We're going to look at David this week, and the next week we're going to look at Solomon, his son. And we're just going to kind of try to get some pointers for our marriages and in our families. We're still within our main series, the story. But David has this crazy family. And you read about some of the things that happen in his family, and you're just going like, really? And I think to myself sometimes when I read some of these things, and he was a man after God's own heart? I mean, if you were trying to categorize David's marriage and his family, I mean, it wouldn't be fairy tale, would it? I mean, it's not happily ever after. To me, it's more like desperate housewives collide with the Jerry Springer show. I mean, that's kind of the way it is. It's just nuts. And You know, I think to myself, David needed a lot of grace when it came to his marriages and his family. And a lot of us, we need that same thing. And as we look at his family, as we begin this morning, before we get into the text, I just want to kind of frame this up with a question for you. If the walls of your house could talk, and I'm sure most of us are really glad they can't, right? Thank goodness they can. But if the walls of your house could talk, what story would they tell? What story would the walls say? Would they tell a story of laughter and joy? Or would they tell a story of conflict and angry words? Maybe you grew up in a house where mom and dad were always just yelling at each other. And you remember going to sleep at night and you'd just be staring at the ceiling, just wishing they'd quit yelling at each other. And maybe you were pulling the pillow over your ears to kind of muffle their yelling. And you said to yourself, I'm not going to yell like my mom yelled. But you find yourself yelling. Or maybe you grew up in a home where dad was kind of unengaged, disengaged, and he was passive. And you said to yourself, I'm not going to be like my dad. And now you find yourself just like your dad. Maybe one of your parents walked out on the other one and you said, I'm not going to walk out. And now you find yourself thinking about walking out. If the walls of your house could speak, what story would they say, tell? Would they tell a story of broken promises? I mean, you know, we all stand before our spouse on our wedding day, and we pledge to them. I mean, we say it, and we mean it, for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and in health. And I mean, we mean it. I mean, we really mean it. But then something happens. Something unexpected happens. We didn't know the plant was going to close. We had to spend 2 years looking for a job. Maybe you didn't know that she was going to struggle with depression. And maybe you didn't know that there was going to be a special needs child kind of thrown in to the mix. And you didn't know that there was going to be like this unexpected attraction to a coworker. And it just seems like you and that coworker were made for each other. And you didn't know that he was going to be so inattentive. And you didn't know that she was just going to give up on looking attractive and not care about that kind of thing. Something happened, and something in your story changes. And the question is, if the walls of your house could speak, what would they say? Would they talk about brokenness? Would they talk about disappointment? You thought it was going to be a love story. Sure. You knew there were going to be problems, right? But somehow you loved each other. You'd get through it, right? And no matter what, you just thought every night, we'll figure this out and we'll go to bed sleeping in each other's arms. And that's not quite how it's working out. Instead, your love story has kind of become like the story of business partners. And it's just kind of a boring story. It's really kind of about managing household chores and handing off the kids for their different extracurricular activities. And romance. Gone a long time ago. And something happened. What would the walls of your house say? So last week we left off with David. Age 30. He takes over the throne of Israel. And initially David is a great king. I mean, everything he touches kind of turns to gold, so to speak. Militarily, he is a great commander-in-chief. I mean, they win victory after victory after victory. In fact, there was one incident where his armies killed 40,000 enemy combatants. And the other kings were so afraid of David that they didn't even want to fight. They surrendered without a fight. The economy of Israel is just flourishing. Trade is going great, and they're expanding their borders. Spiritually, David brings back the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. I mean, everything is just sparkling for David. I mean, if there were national headlines back then, it might say something, you know, like, Shepherd Boy Makes It Big. Or maybe the sign as you're driving into the city limits of Bethlehem would say, Welcome to Bethlehem, birthplace of King David. I mean, he's the man. Everything's great. Until he pushes over the outhouse. Our story today begins in 1 Samuel chapter 11, verse 1. It reads like this. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, by the way, the slide there I messed up is supposed to be 2 Samuel chapter 11. In the spring at the time when kings go off to war, but David remained in Jerusalem. It's springtime. Typically, armies in this part of the world would take off during the wintertime. And they would rest, and then battles would resume again in the spring. So David here, he decides this time he's not going back to war. I'm going to sit this one out, fellas. You guys go on back to war, I'm going to stay here. You'll be fine without me. And then one night, he's in his palace and he can't rest. And so he decides that he's going to go out on the palace roof and maybe watch the sunset and get a little bit of fresh air. And I kind of think that David probably knew what he was going to see when he went out on the top of that palace roof. I don't think it was just an accident. You know, his palace sits higher than everybody else's roof would have set. He would have been easily able to look down, and what would he see? He would see women bathing that time of evening. He's restless. He gets up. He turns on HBO Cinemax. He knew exactly what he was going to see. And he sees Bathsheba. And she's beautiful. And he says, Who is she? And his servant says, That's the wife of Uriah. You know, one of your warriors. And he's like out fighting battles right now for you. That's his wife. That doesn't seem to slow David down. That doesn't deter him a single bit. So he sends for Bathsheba. And an affair takes place. And she becomes pregnant. And now David's got to figure out, how am I going to cover this up? I've got to give the illusion that everything's okay in my family's life and in the palace. Is that not kind of like what happens in our lives? I mean, every Sunday there are lots of families that come into our church, and we all want to give the appearance that everything's okay in my family. Everything. We got it put together. But you know what? There are no perfect families. And every family has a struggle or struggles. Every single one. But we all want to give that illusion. And David is no different. He's trying to cover things up and maintain the illusion that everything is good. So he kind of takes this up to the next level. So he calls for Uriah to come back. And it says in verse 11, Uriah comes back and he wants to make it look like it's Uriah's baby with Bathsheba. But Uriah won't have any part of it. He says, How can I go to my house to eat and drink and make love to my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing. So Uriah has character. He's like, My guys, they're out there bleeding. They're fighting. I'm not going to go stay at home tonight and enjoy the benefits of that. He sleeps on the porch. And so now David's got to do something. So he decides to have Uriah killed. So he gives Uriah a message to take back to his commanding officer. And basically, it's Uriah's death certificate, so to speak. He says, Take this back to your commanding officer. And this is what he says in verse 15. David wrote, Put Uriah out in front where the fighting is the fiercest. Then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die. That's exactly what happens. Uriah is fighting in the fiercest part of the battle. His troops are withdrawn from him. He probably doesn't even realize it. And he's killed. So David, in his cover-up, not only did he commit adultery, now he's committed murder. How did this happen? How does this happen? Adultery? Murder? And you think to yourself, this can't get much more Desperate Housewives Jerry Springer than this. But it does. Because then Amnon, one of David's sons, rapes his half-sister Tamar. And then Absalom, Tamar's full brother, he finds out about it. He plots 2 years to kill his brother Amnon for what he did. And he does. He kills him. This precipitates a civil war between Absalom and David. I mean, David's family is just a train wreck. And we think, how does this all happen? How did this family become such a mess? And you know, usually when there's a breakup in a marriage, it's not usually one incident. It's a series of things that precipitate the breakup. Now, sometimes I talk to people and, you know, there's marriage issues or whatever, and they'll say something like, I don't know how it happened. I just don't know what happened. You know, I came home one day and she left. Or he never came home that night. I just don't know what happened. And these are family members telling me this. They just say that. I don't know what happened. And here's what I've discovered. There's almost always a backstory. There's almost something, always something in the back that's happened. This just isn't like one big thing happen all at once. And I wonder if we just kind of went back in David's story, if we might see some cracks in his story that maybe help us understand a little bit about what happened in David's life. Maybe we'll see some character flaws. I'm not saying necessarily that this would have prevented the breakup or the affair that he had with Bathsheba, but I'm saying there are some things in David's life that if we go back and look at, we can see some cracks in his character. And I also think we can see some things that will help us in our own marriage, strengthen our own marriage. You know, there's a way of telling stories these days. It's called reverse chronology. And you've probably read a book or seen a movie that's like this. If it's in a movie, here's what happens. You're sitting there, and the movie opens up, and it's like crazy intense. I mean, it's characters, and it's just intense. And you're thinking to yourself, I don't get it. What's happening? I don't understand. And then that scene like kind of ends, and then it jumps you way back. And the rest of the movie talks about how they got to that point. So basically it's like you watch the end first, and then you watch the whole rest of the movie that explains how the end happens. It's called reverse chronology. I'm sure you've seen books, seen movies, read books like that. I want to do that a little bit here with David. And I want to kind of go back. And I want to look and see what was going on in David's life before chapter 11, before the affair, before the cover-up, before his kids go bonkers. And just go back and look at some things. So we're going to go back to 2 Samuel chapter 6. Let me just kind of set up the situation here. In 2 Samuel chapter 6, David is married to his first wife, Michal. And this is kind of a very romantic marriage. It's his first marriage. It's the wife of his youth. David was about 18-ish years old when he kills Goliath. We didn't mention this last week, but when he killed Goliath, Saul had made a promise for the man that killed Goliath. Two promises, actually. One promise was, whoever kills Goliath will not ever have to pay taxes for the rest of his life. And then the other was that he would give his daughter in marriage to the person who killed Goliath. Well, the daughter that was supposed to be was Merab. And Merab didn't want any part of that. We read in chapter 17 of 1 Samuel. She didn't want to. But Michal, she was madly in love with David. But David was kind of uncomfortable with this whole situation. He felt like that, you know, just because he was just a commoner, actually he specifically says this, who was he, a commoner, that he should become the son-in-law to the king? So he's like, you know, I'm not royalty. I can't be marrying a royalty. And he's also, there's this whole dowry thing that you had to understand in the ancient Near East. Dowry was, you know, you'd have to give something to the father, the groom who wanted to marry a young lady. He would have to come up with some gifts and give it to the dad. Sometimes it was livestock, sometimes it was money, sometimes it was a combination thereof. And Tatum's thinking, I can't come up with the kind of money that it would take to marry a king's daughter. So Saul kind of helps him out a little bit. He doesn't do it out of the goodness of his heart. He does it really because he's hoping that David will be killed. He tells David, for the dowry, so to speak, if you'll kill 100 Philistines, he's already killed Goliath, then I'll give you Michal to be your wife. So here's what I'm kind of thinking David might have been thinking. Michal. Kind of an unusual name, don't you think, for a girl? Kind of sounds a lot like Michael. I knew a young man at the middle school a few years ago. His name was Michal. So I'm thinking David might be thinking to himself, Michal. That taxes thing sounds pretty good. But Michal, I sure would like to know what she looks like, because that sure sounds boyish, right? He's a guy, right? He's got to want to know what she looks like. So anyway, I think he probably maybe said something like that. I don't know. That's not in the real Bible. It's in the Dennis version. But you know it had to cross his mind, right? So David goes out, and he just doesn't kill 100 Philistines. He kills 200 Philistines. And he brings back proof of that. And he and Michal get married. And so it's also at this point that I told you earlier, chronologically speaking, this is when things are going really good for David. As a king, things are good at the office, so to speak. So he's married, you know, everything is going great. And he brings back the Ark of the Covenant. And I don't know if we can understand what a big deal this was for the nation of Israel. I mean, there is a grand parade, so to speak. It would rival anything that the Macy's Day Thanksgiving parade would be about. I mean, this is just huge. And so David, he's out there celebrating, and he's dancing, and in the celebration, he takes off his robes, and he just dances. And we read in 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 14, wearing a linen ephod, David was dancing before the Lord with all his might before God. With all his might, tells us, he's just totally into this. And then we read in verse 16, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. So Michal, his wife, is watching all this from the window. And she's just kind of embarrassed by the behavior of her husband, especially in front of these slave girls. Some of you wives know what it's like to be embarrassed by your husbands. I mean, some of us just feel like that's part of our job description, right? But she's not too happy here. So David is embarrassing Michal, and she's resenting him. And then we're told that David comes home in verse 20, and it says, when David returned home to bless his household. Bless his household means he comes home. This has been a great day. He's in a great mood. And here's what Michal says. Verse 20, continue. Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, how the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, going around half naked in view of the slave girls of the servants as any vulgar fellow would. So he comes home from a day of celebration, a great day at the office, and the first thing she does is just sarcastically lay into him. Oh, the king was dancing in front of the slave girls in his loincloth. This is basically what she's saying to him. And she just attacks him. So what does David do? He just gives her right back. I mean, he's defensive. Verse 21, he says, David said to Michal, it was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone else from his house. So you know what he does? He starts attacking the in-laws. Now that's a great strategy for solving marital conflict, right? I mean, he's basically saying, hey, your dad, Saul, could do this, so God had to get me to it. So you just be quiet. Okay? And it goes on to say, when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people, I will celebrate before the Lord. David is just celebrating. But that's not how Mikal sees it. Isn't that how a lot of conflicts happen? We just see two different things. Doesn't matter if you're friends or in a marriage or whatever it is. We just see it two different ways. Notice how the story ends. I mean, it's just abrupt. Verse 23. And Mikal, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. You know what that means? In other words, her and David never slept together again. And we never, ever hear about her in Scripture again. And you think, well, what happened? Why do we have this dialogue in Scripture? Why is there like this, so much detail? Why is there like this play-by-play here? Here's what I think. I think God's given us some pointers for our marriage and some pointers for handling conflict. That maybe David's story could have ended differently if things would have happened differently. I mean, what if David would have included his wife in the celebration? What if she would have made sure that she was by his side in the parade when they were celebrating? What if Mikal would have been encouraging to her husband? It was a great day for him. What if she would have given him a big hug and said, I'm proud of you. I'm so proud of you for bringing back the Ark of the Covenant for our people. What if David would have tried to listen a little bit and maybe see things from her perspective? What if there hadn't been sarcasm right out of the gate? What if criticism would have been replaced by praise? What if there hadn't been personal attacks? What if she had not been so insecure and defensive? What if someone would have said, I'm sorry? What if someone would have said, forgive me? What if David would have pursued Mikal at this point with the same passion that he fought Goliath with? Could that have made the story different? How would it have changed it? Here's what I'm convinced of. The stories of our lives, the stories of our marriages, the stories of our families are told in the moments, the moment by moment of daily living. Those seemingly insignificant moments that happen every day in our lives. That's where our stories are told of our marriages and our families and our relationships. You know, sometimes we see the big moment. We see the David and Bathsheba affair. We think, that's when it happened. We see the breakup of someone's marriage and whatever the reason was, and that's why it happened. But it's probably not. That's just the end. It's the moment by moment of our daily relationships, our daily activities, the things that we say and do. We tend to notice the one big moment where everything falls apart. But there are cracks, even right now, that are leading up to that. It's like this. When I lived in North Carolina, we had the remnants of a hurricane. I believe it was Hurricane Opal, but don't quote me on that. That came up, the remnants of it, and it was just devastating to the mountain area there. And we had this huge tree, I mean a big, big tree, fall down in our pasture, and it took out the fence. And so the next day, we need to get it taken care of pretty quick, or, you know, the horses were going to skedaddle. And so I go down there with some of the guys from the camp, and we're going to cut up that tree. And here's what I noticed. This monster tree was rotted on the inside. I mean, it was absolutely rotting. That tree had been falling for a long time. It was just the wind that had kind of finished it off. And that's the way a lot of these situations are. Many times it's not that moment. It's just that moment that kind of topples it. One author described it this way. When we get married, in our marriage, we give our spouse some kind of burden to carry. I brought with me this morning a rock, a big rock. Sean found this rock and kind of kept it because you can tell it's got a lot of quartz in it. It kind of sparkles. I don't know if you can see that in the light. But I want this rock to kind of represent the burden that we're talking about here. And we say to our wives, and we say to our husbands, we say to our spouse, would you carry this burden for me? And maybe that burden is workaholism. And your spouse has kind of handed that to you. And they're working all the time. And so they've asked you to carry that. Or maybe the rock is a hot temper. Or passivity. And because you love him, you are mentally determined to carry that rock. Maybe it's a bigger rock. Maybe it's this big. And maybe it's an addiction. Alcohol, gambling. I don't know what it could be. But they've asked you to carry it. Or maybe your spouse has handed you the rock of criticism and negativity and nagging. And you say, well, I'm going to carry it. And mentally, you are determined to carry that. And you do it for a while. But then eventually, something happens. And just mentally and emotionally, you're just exhausted and you just can't do it anymore. I mean, it'd be like if I asked somebody to just hold this over their head indefinitely. Wouldn't happen. It's a pretty heavy rock. At some point, their arms are going to wear out and they're going to drop it. And when they drop that rock, it's going to break something. When we drop that burden, things just kind of shatter and they splinter. And everybody wants to point at the time that the rock was dropped. Yeah, that's when it happened. But that's not when it happened. It's not that moment. The rock has been carried for a long time. And we ask our families to carry these burdens and these rocks, and they're fine. You say, my spouse, they can carry the rock of me constantly being out of town. I know she says we need to be more intentional, but she's carried the rock a long time. She'll be fine. He's been carrying that rock for a long time. I know he wants me to be a little more positive and not be so critical and negative. I know that. But he's going to be fine. He's carried the rock for a long time. I know my kids can carry the rock of us yelling at each other. I mean, kids, they're resilient. They're kids. They'll be fine. And they are for a while. And your kids and your spouse, they want to carry the rock. They want to carry that burden because they love you. But at some point, they just get overcome. And they drop it and it breaks. Well, that never happened to me. We've been married forever. He or she will just keep on carrying that rock. I don't have to worry about it. Really. This is something I think you'll find interesting. Divorce rates in our country in almost every age group have gone down. Except for one group. You know what group it is? The 50 and over group. They call them gray divorces. And they have doubled in the last 20 years. 25% of all divorces in our country now are people over the age of 50. I mean, you would never think that. What's happened? They can't carry the rock anymore. They've carried it for years and years and years, and one day they just can't carry it anymore. Don't take your spouse, your family, for granted. So what are some helpful things that we can pull out of this, like practical things for our marriages out of this story? I want to mention four things to you. First of all, identify what the issue is. I know that's difficult to do sometimes. Believe me, I know it's hard sometimes. I mean, Michael, she just lays into David the minute he comes in, and David's immediately defensive. But what would have happened if David would have really listened? Maybe the reason that Michal felt this way is because that she wanted to be invited along to celebrate. Or maybe she was just being insecure because all those beautiful young slave girls were dancing around with David. And maybe that's really what it was, insecurity. And she just needed to be affirmed that she was still number one. in David's life. Identify what the real issue is. Is the issue really that your husband comes home late? Or is the issue is even when he comes home, he's still text messaging and doing emails, and it's like even though he's home, mentally he's not really home. And that's the real issue. Identify what the real issue is. Secondly, in day-to-day marriage, find a good time and place for difficult conversations. As soon as David walks in the door, pow! She just lets him have it. Maybe there need to be a little bit of space there. You need to give your, not do this in the heat of the moment, so to speak. And maybe it would have been good if David would have been a little more mature and said, look, instead of just firing back at her, said, look, just give me a little bit of room here. Let me breathe for a little while, and then we can talk about this. It's important to find the right time and the right place where you can set aside some of the emotion and really discover the issue and then how to deal with it. Third, stick to the issue. What does David do? He immediately expands it to the in-laws. Is that not what we do a lot in conflict? You get in a conflict with your spouse, and then somebody's like, well, you remember 5 years ago? It's like, how do we get there? You remember 3 months ago when you said? I'm a guy. I don't remember what I said 3 months ago. But is that not what we do? We expand the argument. Stick to the issue. Lastly, start with a positive. Maybe Mikhail could have said something like, sweet dance moves. I don't know. But something kind of positive here, right? Instead of just barging in there with all this criticism and negativity. David comes home. And I'm not getting on ladies this morning, and I'm not getting, well, we're going to talk about men and ladies, how we can improve here. I'm not getting on anybody in particular. But you know what David wants when he comes home? Because I'm a guy, and I know what he wants. He wants to impress his wife. That's what guys want. And what David wants is for his wife to be as impressed with him as those slave girls were. That's what he wants. He wants her to come in and for her to say, honey, I am so proud of you. You brought back the Ark of the Covenant. This is a wonderful thing you've done for our nation. As a guy, I know that's what he wants. But instead, he gets criticism. He wants to impress her, but she's critical. Some of you know what it's like to live with this. Kind of criticism and negative spirit. Proverbs 21:9 says this: better to live in a desert than with a quarrelsome and nagging wife. That's saying it's better for you that if your wife is one of those that wants to fight all the time and no matter what you say it sets her off. This is what this is saying. It's better for you, brother, that you just go walking out in the desert and die. That's what it says. And then there's another place in Scripture talking about this, and it says a nagging and critical wife is like the constant drip of water. Drip, 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 drip. It's like you ladies are waterboarding your husbands in some way. It doesn't work. And guys, we talked about this a lot in men's fraternity, especially in the early days. We still bring it up occasionally. Men's fraternity is our men's group that meets on Wednesday nights at 6:30 over here in the new building. We talked about how men can be passive sometimes. And as men, the Bible doesn't call us to be passive. The Bible calls men to be the leaders of their home. It calls them to be the spiritual leaders. And we're to lead our homes. And we're to serve our kids and our wives with sacrifice and humility and gentleness. That's how we should lead. Now, I will tell you this, nothing, and I'm not making excuses, but nothing will drive a man to being passive quicker than negativity and criticism and nagging all the time. It's like, well, I can't do anything right. No matter what I do, it's not right. If I do it, it's not good enough. If I don't do it, I get in trouble. And finally, he's like, enough, I'm just going to sit in my lazy boy and watch sports all day. That's what happens. This morning, we are calling out men, like the Bible does, to be the spiritual leaders of the home, to lead the home, to serve our family. And we're calling out women to be the encouragers. Michal is sarcastic and negative. What would have happened if David would have apologized and listened? Because listen, guys. The Bible tells us to love our wives as Christ loved the church, right? Ephesians chapter 5. And what did Christ do for the church? He gave his life for the church and he reconciled the church. He was the reconciler. He was the pursuer. So if we're to love like Christ loved, that means we are to be the pursuer in the relationship. We're to be the reconciler in the relationship. So it means we're the ones, guys, that need to go and say, I'm sorry. And you think, well, you know, I didn't do anything wrong. Wrong answer. He's not getting the point. You take the high ground and you go and you apologize. I'm sure there's something you can apologize for. Well, you don't understand. It was only like 5% my fault and 95% her fault. Well, you can apologize for the 5% then. Just don't tell her you're just apologizing for the 5%. Don't do that. But that's what Scripture tells us to do. You're the pursuer in the relationship. What would have happened in David's story if that would have been kind of his MO through all the marriages and relationships that he had? Maybe things would have gone in a different direction. Maybe your life will go in a different, your relationships will go in a different direction if you put some of this into practice here. If the walls of your house could talk, what would they say? It would be a story of anger and disappointment and brokenness and conflict and bitterness. It would be a story of love and grace and God's redeeming power. Because that's what God wants our walls to say. That's what he wants our families to say. He wants us to tell the story of him redeeming us and his grace and his mercy. And how he can put the broken pieces back together. And here's what you see if you continue reading David's story. There's a lot of circumstances that happen. But eventually, David asks for forgiveness. And he has to suffer some consequences for what he did. But God takes this whole mess, David's family and the affair, and he glorifies himself with that. And you know, on any given Sunday, there are people that have experienced exactly what David's experienced. In our nation, and churches, our church and churches across this nation, there are people that have messed up. Some of them have committed adultery. Some of them have committed other types of sins, embezzlement, whatever it is. And they've gone to God and they've asked for forgiveness and he's redeemed them. And today, they're singing in choirs and singing in praise bands and working in coffee shops and working in parking lots. And they're rocking babies in nurseries and working in children's departments and working with youth. Because they've experienced God's forgiveness. They are people who've made king-size mistakes like David. But through God's love and forgiveness, they serve God and they love on people. Maybe that's part of the point this morning. That not only can God forgive David of his awful mistake, but he can also forgive you and I. Would you let God do that in your life? Both the forgiveness that comes for a Christian, we make mistakes, but also maybe you're here this morning and you mess up your life over and over and over and you don't understand what I'm talking about when I talk about a personal relationship with God and you just keep trying to fix it yourself and it's just not working. I would love to talk to you about the forgiveness that God offers. If you come to him and you believe that he died on a cross and he died for everyone's sin, including yours and mine, those mistakes and those mess ups that we have, and he offers forgiveness and he offers us eternal life. He gives us a chance to do it over. Have you done that? Can I pray for us this morning?